University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today, animal abuse and family violence, a global concern. My guest is known to University Forum. He's been here before. Mr. Phil Arco. Welcome to University Forum again, Mr. Arco.
Thanks, Jean. Glad to be back.
Mr. Arco is the chairman of the Animal Abuse and Family Violence Prevention Project for the California-based Latham Foundation. And I must add that he is also the marketing and communications officer for the Philadelphia Foundation.
That's right. I work in the philanthropic field, and it's a joy to do that.
Well, our topic today is going to deal with something that I know is close to your heart because of the animal abuse problems in which you have been so much involved. Last time we talked is some time ago, and now we're putting our conversation around the global aspect of this very terrible problem. What, again, is your definition of animal abuse and also the linkage to family violence? Problems.
Well, let me bring our listeners up to date because it's been a few years since I've been on the air and just kind of explain what the situation is. The United States has the interesting distinction of having the oldest statutes in the world to prevent cruelty to animals. They actually predate the formation of the United States. They date back to Massachusetts in 1641. And it's been a long established history in the U.S. and in many, many other countries of the world, too, that animals should not be harmed. Now, these laws were enacted largely because common law has always said that animals are property. They legally fit in the same category as toasters. And it's not because legislators have any belief in inherent rights of animals as much as just the general belief that harming animals says something bad about us as a society, as a civilization, and it disturbs or destroys somebody else's property, and so it's illegal. So we have had these laws on our books for 350 years now. Many other countries have had these as well. And they are enforced haphazardly at best, usually by SPCAs, occasionally by municipal animal control authorities or local police departments. But they don't enjoy the same degree of community widespread support that so many other laws enjoy. Largely began because animals are considered to be property. People often make excuses. They say, oh, it was only a cat or it was only a squirrel or boys will be boys. You know, what's the big deal? And so consequently, the SPCAs of this country and, again, around the world have a very difficult time mustering enough community support to get people to take animal abuse seriously. And my background before I went to work for the Philadelphia Foundation was 30 years with humane societies and SPCAs. And in that work, I saw and continue to see now from the outside, but continue to see just an incredible number of cases of people either just inadvertently harming animals without knowing what they were doing or deliberately mistreating animals. And, of course, the animals are suffering as a result. And not a lot of recognition for how serious the problem is. Beginning in the 1970s, there started to be some significant research out there that began to show that harming animals was a distinct psychological condition and was a precursor to more exaggerated forms of violence that usually take shape in harming people. And over the last 30 years, we've just gotten more and more research that substantiates this. When we first started looking at this in the 1980s, we found that a significant number of serial killers all had examples of animal abuse in their background. The school shooters in the 1990s, we ran into the same situation, where at least half of them have had instances of severely harming animals. And there have been a number of us around the world who've been looking at this now and revisiting it, you know, through a new lens and looking at it as what it should be, not a crime against an animal or a crime against property, but reconsidering it as part of the continuum of family violence.
Before you go further in that line, more recently there have been a number of situations where multiple animals have been ill-kempt, ill-fed, and abused. And these, of course, have caused a great reaction from the public. But that's been set aside and not linked up with any relationship to abuse of families.
It's part of the same continuum on a slightly different tangent. When we're talking about animal abuse or animal cruelty, and by the way, I prefer the term abuse rather than cruelty because cruelty implies malicious intent on the part of the perpetrator, whereas abuse follows the child protection model, and it just says that maltreatment occurred regardless of what the perpetrator's intent was. When an investigator from an SPCA goes into what we call a hoarder situation or a collector situation, and this is the stereotypical little old lady living in a trailer with 37 cats and cat feces 6 inches high on the floor and, you know, a refrigerator full of cat food but no human food for herself, there is obviously a situation in need of social services intervention. And this is a woman who needs some help on a lot of different levels. And the cats are just the tip of the iceberg. And usually the first thing that prompts a social service agency, an SPCA, to get involved and work with it, and then theoretically they will make a referral to the appropriate Department of Social Services. So that's one type of abuse. The other type of abuse is when somebody deliberately harms an animal, or many animals, and the SPCA is brought in, and they see some other example, and then again they make a referral to the appropriate law enforcement agency or some other type of agency that, may be involved. We had a case of that in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, back in 1999, where the neighbors were concerned about the welfare of a Great Dane that was freezing on a very cold January night. They entered the house. They called the police department. Police came in, entered the house, found a dead 5-year-old boy who had been killed. The man who was the head of the household had fled with his wife and several other children, both his own and foster children, subsequently picked up in Atlanta, and just this past summer, 5 years later, was finally convicted and was sentenced to 22 years in prison. Now, again, this is a case of where the animals trigger a response because people aren't going to get involved with, something else. What's interesting is that 5 years, I'm sorry, 4 years before the animal incident, he had been convicted of domestic violence. And 4 years before that, he had been convicted of cruelty to animals.
So you're dealing with an individual who has a way of being abusive to both animals and people.
Exactly right. And what we're finding, and there's new research coming out all the time, is that people who have a violent tendency and take it out in a family violence context pick on the most opportunistic member. And whether that victim has two legs or four legs is often a matter of chance or convenience as much as anything else. And all too frequently, where we're really seeing it, is in the domestic violence arena, in which a batterer who wants to keep usually the woman in the household at bay, keep her off guard, keep her trapped in an abusive relationship, will use the animals as pawns to keep her under control. He may harm or threaten the animals and say, "I did this to your rabbit. This is what will happen to you if you leave." He may humiliate her with sexual acts involving the animals. She may just be unable to leave because she's afraid of what will happen to the pets, or in rural areas, what happens to the livestock if she leaves. And we have studies after study after study that are showing anywhere up to as many as 40% of battered women are trapped in abusive relationships and can't escape because of fear of what will happen to their pets.
Talk a little bit about these studies now. Who does the studies, and how do you know what methodology they use?
One of the interesting things about this is how multidisciplinary it is. We have research coming out of the psychology field, from the sociology field, from social work, from veterinary medicine, psychiatry. They're all good research studies, and they're published in a number of academic journals, again, coming from a wide variety of backgrounds. And they're just gradually increasing on a weekly basis the extent of what we know about animal abuse and how it ties in from a law enforcement standpoint, from a social work standpoint, from a veterinary medical standpoint. I just got some interesting studies in from the police department in Sydney, Australia, where they're looking at the fact that the most common denominator that they find in perpetrators of sexual assault, sexual homicide, is incidents of animal abuse. And none of the other markers that they've ever had as precursors, you know, are showing up as strongly as this. And so what they're saying in Australia is that perhaps we ought to integrate the data of the law enforcement agencies with the data from the Australian SPCAs, so that when we have a serial killer or serial rapist out there, you know, if we look at the database of animal abusers, we might be able to find our killer on those ranks.
So that suggests that the securing of data to substantiate and to find some changes can cut across many areas and many continents.
Exactly right. And one of the challenges we faced with a lot of this is that the agencies that have been involved have rarely talked to each other. They've gone down their little avenues, their little individual silos.
Right here in the United States, or right in the state of Pennsylvania?
Right here in Montgomery County.
Montgomery County.
Yeah, okay, that was as classic a case as any. And, you know, they just haven't thought to share information because everybody is overworked and they're stretched to the limit in their own particular field. And when they go out on a case, it just doesn't occur to them to look outside their window. I just did a training session down in Delaware last week for probation and parole officers. First time we talked to that group. You know, because they're out there supervising or monitoring the batterers in domestic violence situations, and they're making house calls to make sure everything's okay. And they need to be taught, you know, when you go in there, look at the welfare of the animals, and if you see something that looks like it could possibly be abuse, call, in that case, the Delaware SPCA, and they will check it out. And conversely, we're telling animal protection people around the country, when you're out there on an animal case, if you see kids who look like they're abused, if you see a woman who looks like she's in an abusive relationship, talk to them, do some counseling, see if they need a referral, let them know about what the other agencies are in the community that might be able to help them.
Help me with this. What's your thought on how this should actually be addressed? Should animal abuse be carried by primarily a private or a public agency? And if so, how does that get monitored?
It can work either way. It varies from community to community. One of the challenges in animal protection work is that there are about 3,500 nonprofit, independent, completely autonomous SPCAs and humane societies, all of whom answer only to themselves. There's no national umbrella and there's no franchise or anything like that. So they each work differently and they each have varying degrees of powers, authorities, legitimacy, and abilities. And then in many communities, you have government-run animal control agencies, which are usually run by a city or a county government. And again, they have varying degrees of power and authority. So then you have some places like New Jersey where it's only the state-run SPCA that has the authority to investigate cruelty, and they don't have anywhere near the resources to do it that would be ideal to do on a local level with locally trained people.
So what's the common thread and the common response that may be needed to make this more effective than it is right now?
The common thread is for people to recognize that harming animals is a human welfare issue. And that the sooner we begin to put it on the same par as child abuse and domestic violence, people will recognize that it is a serious social concern, that the SPCAs represent another, or the government animal control officers, represent another line of investigation, additional eyes and ears out there in the community, a core of people who are trained and who actually see more people in the course of the day than other community service agencies. Now, having said that, I also need to caution that we are not saying that animals are more important than people, because that always gets hairs raised on the back of a lot of people's necks. What we're saying is that violence is violence, and it doesn't matter if the victim has two legs or four legs. It's something that we won't tolerate. And by working with the human service and the humane service agencies and bringing them together, we might get a better handle on the problem.
You're listening to University Forum. My guest, Mr. Phil Arco, the director of the Animal Abuse and Family Violence Prevention Project for the California-based Latham Foundation, and someone who has been involved in all kinds of issues related to animal abuse and the relationship to family and particularly child abuse. I notice you've done a lot of training manuals and linkages and all kinds of activities. So how do you link up and make a difference as to what's happening in this country with other countries? You mentioned Australia. There are some countries around the world where certain animals are considered sacred, and then there are others where animals are used as appetizers, if you will, for consumption by people. Mm-hmm. What's going on out there? Open our eyes to the broader global issue here.
Well, as word of this kind of work across the U.S. has spread, and there are a number of us who are involved with what we call the link between animal abuse and other forms of family violence, the word has spread across our borders. And I've been involved with a number of efforts in other countries. Most recently, I was in Brazil last fall with a rather interesting scenario. Now, if you were to ask the average listener out there to name the third largest city on the planet, I doubt that most people would think of San Paulo, Brazil.
By the way, that came up on one of the quiz shows this morning.
Okay. It's an enormous city, 19 million people. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagining a city, 12 times the size of Philadelphia or something mm-hmm. like that. 19 million people in the city, 40 million people in the state, and a crime problem that will not quit and dwarfs anything that we have in this mm-hmm. country. In the state of San Paulo itself, for example, there are 150,000 police officers. And their emergency system, their 911 system, gets 150,000 phone calls a day.
For any emergency?
For any emergencies. They had 21 prisons in the state in 1995. They now have 122 prisons. Okay. So this is about as bad a crime situation as you're going to find anywhere in the world. Yet despite all that, they invited me to come to talk to 400 of their police officers about animal abuse. They have an interesting situation down there. I've never seen anything like it. Their police force is divided into three divisions. They have the military police, which would be the equivalent of our field officers, our regular police department. Then they're the civil police, which are the prosecutors. But then they have an environmental police group, which has been there for 55 years, and it's apparently the model for Latin America. And these officers handle everything from wetlands and marshlands preservation to dealing with endangered species to protecting wild animals that are being poached and shipped to the United States as exotic species to hunting and fishing issues and domestic animals. And they get 8,000 calls a year for mistreated animals. And so I had to do a training session for them in English, which was translated into Portuguese. To sensitize them to the fact that the work that they're doing, which is vitally important, has this human welfare connection and is very often a lead into other issues that other parts of the police department will find of interest.
With all of the crime and with the vastness of that particular city and of the country of Brazil, which has such beautiful parts as well, how did they find time and interest to zero in on this aspect with you?
It was the result of one woman who just kept pushing and pushing and pushing and then just kept making it known. And she finally got the ear of the Minister of State Security.
Is that right?
Okay. And he agreed to give it some support. And, when the El Jefe speaks, mm-hmm. people listen.
That's right.
And that's how it happened. And one of the things that amazes me about this work is how so much can be done with just, the power of one person. That's what happened in South Africa. I've been down there twice now doing some work with them. Of one woman in Cape Town who just was relentless at this. And South Africa is an interesting situation. I mean, we talk about diversity and multiculturalism here in the U.S. We can't even begin to fathom what that means until you get to a country like South Africa, which is not only coming out of apartheid and all the emotional turmoil that has brought about, but they have 11 national languages and a crime situation that is rampant. I can travel all over the world and I feel perfectly comfortable, except in Johannesburg. That scared me. It's just a bizarre scene when every place you see is behind barbed wire and high gate fences and there are armed security guards everywhere just because there is so much crime. And in the midst of all that and a rape rate that is 4 times greater than the United States and a homicide rate that's 11 times greater than the United States, what are they talking about? Animal abuse.
Mm.
And getting people to recognize that by incorporating humane education into schools and getting children to begin feeling empathy for other creatures, that this will extend into their treating other human beings, other human animals with respect and cutting down on the violence. This woman who just heads a small animal rights group was able to get a provision inserted into the national education curriculum for South Africa. South Africa's constitution mandates that every school child in South Africa will have environmental education. And the environment down there is just so spectacular, and they've got so much wildlife
Beautiful.
To preserve. It's absolutely fabulous. And she got this provision inserted into that. This is 9% of that environmental education will be directed to humane education and getting people to getting kids to recognize kindness to animals. And then she took it one step further, and we provided some training for some police officers in Cape Town, and that's going national. And they're going to be doing this training to every law enforcement agency in the entire country.
Hmm. That's unbelievable to have had that kind of zeroing in on that particular issue in a place that has so many other kinds of problems.
Well, it could be because all the other approaches aren't working.
Mm-hmm. And it's a way of linking up what goes on between animals and violence. I would imagine that there is a lot of family abuse in that area.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, I mean, family abuse exists everywhere.
Yeah.
I just got an invitation to do some training in Hungary, and just looking at the list of the agencies that are involved. I mean, it just sounds like you were in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or Chicago. I mean, it's just they're dealing with the same types of problems, the same types of agencies, and the same, you know, people who are struggling to find a solution.
Now, you've had some contacts with Canada and with United Kingdom?
Yes, I've done some workshops in both countries. The Canadians are actually a little bit ahead of the U.S. In one key area, or they have, let me rephrase that, they have the potential to be ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
Canada's national anti-cruelty law against animals was written in 1888, I believe it was, and has not really been changed since. And that's a fairly standard pattern in most states around the country. There has been a provision or proposal in Parliament in Ottawa for about 10 years now to move crimes against animals out of the section that would be considered a crime against property and instead move it into another area of the national law, which would be a crime of violence, which is where it belongs. This has passed the House of Commons in Canada 3 times now in the past few years, but their Senate, which is a different concept than our Senate, these are people who are appointed for life, so they're not answerable to the voters. It's more like a House of Lords in the UK. The Senate just keeps...
Perpetuates
itself, and they keep stalling the bill, and then every time they change government, so they got to start all over again. Mm-hmm. So it's been through 3 prime ministers, and it keeps rising up.
Because they're going to stay.
Right. The UK is doing some marvelous things, particularly in Scotland, but they've got national training initiatives between the Scottish SPCA and the state or the National Law Enforcement Academy. We've got veterinary groups now in Canada, the UK, the US, and New Zealand that have chimed in to get veterinarians brought into this and to recognize the role of veterinarians, which is similar to pediatricians and emergency room personnel when it came time to start identifying their roles in child abuse. But getting veterinarians to recognize that they have a significant role, not only in the fact that they will see abused animals, but that they will see abused women and abused kids who are coming into the clinics for treatment, or the large animal practitioner who's going out to the ranch or the farm, you know, to treat the livestock, will actually see the people on their home turf. And to recognize that veterinarians have a role to play in either counseling and educating people about violence prevention, and if that fails, to make referrals to the appropriate agencies.
And there are not that many veterinary schools in our country.
There are now 32 and 4 in Canada. And many of them are now introducing this into the curricula.
Because they have another dimension than what has typically been thought of as the veterinary task, in addition to treating those animals, seeing those linkages to other aspects of human life.
We have known since 1976 that veterinarians see more human clients than animal patients.
Mm-hmm. But now it seems that the urge to include them in this admixture of social networks.
Absolutely. And veterinarians, as far as I'm concerned, are family practitioners.
Mm-hmm. But does it work that way, or is this new?
It's a new concept. Veterinary medicine is unique in that it has twin heritages. It comes from not only a medical background, but an agricultural background. And the history has largely been farm animals, okay, with an economic mm-hmm. impact. Over the last 40 or 50 years, you know, the power within the American Veterinary Medical Association, the veterinary community, has shifted in some degree. The money is still in large animals, but, you know, the bulk of the practitioners are in companion animals. And there's also many more female veterinarians these days than there used to be. And women vets are much more sensitive to the domestic violence issues. This concern is now beginning to resonate more within the practice, within the profession than it did before.
Let's kind of tie into what you see as where it's going and what's needed. In terms of, say, legislation, what needs to happen in order to make this mandatory for things to take place?
Well, a number of things. What we've seen over the past few years is that we now have 42 states that have made some form of animal cruelty a felony as opposed to misdemeanor. This gets the whole criminal justice system to treat it with more respect and more seriousness, and gets more state resources and law enforcement agencies involved. We're also seeing research in terms of trying to identify the reasons why people harm animals, trying to identify the clinical conditions similar to what we've had in the child protection field for years, so that a veterinarian can look at a type of injury, a type of a burn, and say, you know, I suspect this was non-accidental injury as opposed to the cat fell down a flight of stairs. And the woman who's leading the charge on that is from Scotland, actually. She's doing some marvelous things. So we're seeing some good work in that area there. We're finding that there are a lot of programs that are being set up in terms of providing foster care for pets belonging to battered women. These are called safe haven programs. There are about 200 of them now across the U.S., probably more by now. And also education programs in which at-risk youth are being put in environments where they're training unadoptable animal shelter dogs to make them more adoptable using nonviolent techniques so that they can see the results of their work and it's positive reinforcement, and boys are working with girls and just some marvelous things that are going on.
What about the need for any kind of therapeutic response to when the youngsters or others are involved in committing these kinds of crimes?
Legislatively, the number of states now require a perpetrator of animal abuse to undergo anger management or counseling programs. Mm-hmm. Again, this is similar to what happened in the domestic violence field. We're also seeing a number of states in which the list of those who are mandated by law to report suspected family violence, either animal abuse or child abuse, is expanding, so that we're seeing veterinarians mandated to report, or we're seeing animal control officers mandated to report, or child protection workers now have to report suspected child abuse. And mm-hmm. So, you know, we need more of that.
Well, as you think about it globally, and think of what takes place when there are other kinds of disasters, as the Somali one, you think about all the needs for both the animals and the people who are there, and those folks who had lost pets and what it did to them, even in that.
One of the most remarkable women I've ever met in my life is working in a program in Bali in Sumatra, and she was the first on the scene after the tsunamis and has been working in India, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and the Aceh province. And they are sterilizing upwards of 30,000, 40,000 dogs because they're afraid of a rabies outbreak.
Yeah.
And again, it's the human health and welfare aspects of animals that's prompting this. You know, obviously, you know, there's a huge toll of human life, human suffering, human costs, but the animals have to be included in all that work as well.
So in a word or two as we end, your message to those who are listening, who are just individuals, just a word,
is it's not just a dog, it's not just a cat, it's a member of our family.
Oh, thank you so much, Phil Arco, for coming and sharing this very, very important topic with us. You've been listening to a conversation on animal abuse and family violence, a global concern. If you would like more information on the relationship between abuse to animals and abuse to people, particularly children and women, you may reach Mr. Phil Arco, an international expert on this serious issue, at the Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417. I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments or questions on University Forum programs to me by email at jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail at 215-204-4376.